The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I said at dinner, I will say again tonight to you, that Benjamin Franklin is my favorite founding father. Is anybody who would try to outlaw slavery at the Constitutional Convention and then write an essay on farting and then go fly a kite in a thunderstorm is my kind of guy. Now, how many of you heard me speak before? All right, well, it's not going to be the same old crap about how we all need extended families and other speeches. I say we, you know, as human beings, we can do without extended families as easily as we can do without essential minerals or vitamins. It's the reason so many of us feel lousy is we don't have this essential part of human life as an extended family. I will say this on that subject. 50% of American marriages are going bust. I assume that's half the people here. And you should understand that when you fight with your spouse, it's not about money. It's not about sex. It's not about power. What each person is saying to the other one is, you're not enough people. When you get married now, all you do is get one person instead of a whole bunch of relatives. And I know all your stupid jokes. I know how you look when you eat. And you know, if you're just not enough people, and that's why the marriages are all busting up now. Freud said that he didn't know what women want. Well, I know what they want. They want a whole lot of people to talk to. And what do they want to talk about? They want to talk about everything. Now, I've said that in several speeches, and then women have agreed. They think this is pretty good. But then they say, what is it men want? And all I could come up with is, please don't get mad at me. Now, I am most famous, I think, because of something I didn't do. There's a woman, Mary Smeach, on the Chicago Tribune in June or so, wrote a charming essay as a mock graduation speech, is recommending that people use sunblock and so forth. And then in August, some creep put this out on the internet and said that it was my speech to the graduating class at MIT, and it was adorable. Is people still congratulate me on it, and I didn't do it. But I do actually give graduation speeches, and most recently at Rice University in Houston. And George Bush and his darling wife were there because he had a grandson graduating in that class. Now, I think you should know what a graduation address like me sounds like from me. So please become young again, 20, 21, 22. You are about to graduate from Rice University, which is a great university. You will be mainly engineers and architects, but there's a very strong liberal arts department there. And you haven't gotten your diplomas yet, but you will. And this is what I say to you upon graduation. Hello. This is a long-delayed puberty ceremony. You are at last officially full-grown men and women, what you were biologically by the age of 15 or so. I'm sorry as I can be that it took so long and cost so much for you to at least at last receive licenses as grown-ups. I have not calculated how much your diplomas cost in time or money, whatever those ballpark figures are. They surely deserve this reaction from me today is wow, wow, wow. Thank you, and God bless you and those who made it possible for you to study at this great American university, and it is a great university. By becoming informed and reasonable and capable to have made this a better world than it was before you got here. Have we met before? No. But I have thought a lot about people like you. You men here are Adam. You women here are Eve. Who hasn't thought a lot about Adam and Eve? This is Eden, and you're about to be kicked out. Why? Well, you ate the knowledge apple. It's in your tummies now. And who am I? Well, I used to be Adam, but now I'm Methuselah. So what does this Methuselah have to say to you since he has lived so long? I'll pass on to you what another Methuselah said to me. He's Joe Heller, author, as you know, of Catch-22. We were at a party thrown by a multi-billionaire out on Long Island, and I said, Joe, how does it make you feel to realize that only yesterday our host probably made more money than Catch-22 has earned in its entire publishing history all over the world? Joe said to me, I have something he can never have. And I said, Joe, what the hell is that? And he said, the knowledge that I have enough. Not bad, huh? He's a good writer, too. His example may be of comfort to many of you, Adams and Eves, who in later life have to admit that something has gone terribly wrong and that despite the education you received here, you have somehow failed to become billionaires. This is a sort of tragedy that befalls people who pay attention to anything but the bottom line. Well-dressed people ask me sometimes, with their teeth bared as though they would like to bite me, if I believe in the redistribution of wealth. I can only reply that it doesn't matter what I think, that wealth is always being redistributed every hour, often in ways which are absolutely fantastic. Nobel Prizes are peanuts when compared with what a linebacker for the Cowboys makes in a single season nowadays. For about 100 years now, the most lucrative prize for a person who had made a really meaningful contribution to the culture of the world as a physicist, a chemist, a physiologist, a physician, a writer, or God bless him or her, a maker of peace, has been a Nobel Prize. It is about $1 million now. Those dollars come, incidentally, from a fortune made by a Swede who mixed clay with nitroglycerin and gave us dynamite. Kaboom. Alfred Nobel intended that his prizes make the planet's most valuable inhabitants independently wealthy so that their work could not be inhibited or bent this way or that by powerful politicians or patrons. But $1 million is only a white chip now. In a world of sports and entertainment on Wall Street and many lawsuits as compensation, for executives of our larger corporations. $1 million in the tabloids and on the evening news is chump change in 1998. I'm reminded of a scene in a W.C. Fields movie in which Fields is watching a poker game in a saloon in a gold rush town. Fields announces his presence by putting a $100 gold piece on the table. The players barely look up from the game. One of them finally says, give him a white chip. But the cost of a college education, a minor fraction of $1 million, is anything but chump change for most Americans. have academic degrees, in the past been passports to international glory, to wealth, to grotesquely out of scale with the needs of ordinary families, in a few cases. Rice can no doubt name a handful of celebrities who came from here, but most graduates from Rice are from Harvard or Oxford or the Sorbonne or any place else you care to name, have been of use locally rather than nationally. They have commonly been rewarded with modest but adequate amounts of money and even less fame. In place of fame, they may have had to be content with someone's seemingly heartfelt thanks for something from time to time. In time, this will prove to have been the destiny of most, but not all, of the Adams and Eves in the class of 1998 at Rice. They will find themselves building or strengthening their communities. Please love such a destiny if it turns out to be yours. For communities are all that is substantial about what we create or defend or maintain in this world. All the rest is hoopla. For your footloose generation, that community could easily be New York City or Washington, D.C. or Paris or Houston, or Adelaide, Australia, or Shanghai, or Kuala Lumpur. Mark Twain, at the end of a profoundly meaningful life, for which he never received a Nobel Prize, asked himself what it was we all live for. He came up with six words which satisfied him. They satisfy me too. They should satisfy you. The good opinion of our neighbors. Neighbors are people who know you, can see you, can talk to you, to whom you may have been of some help or beneficial stimulation. They are not nearly as numerous as the fans say of Madonna or Michael Jordan. To earn their good opinions, you should apply the special skills you've learned here and meet the standards of decency and honor and fair play set by exemplary books and elders. It's even money that one of you will get a Nobel Prize, want to bet? It's only $1 million, but what the heck? That's better than a sharp stick in the eye, as the saying goes. Now, this speech is almost twice as long as the most efficient oration ever uttered by an American, Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. Lincoln, incidentally, was murdered by a ham actor, the founder of this university, William Marsh Rice, was murdered by a faithless servant in New York City. In 1900. But the good these men did lives after them. Up to this point, the speech has been new stuff, written for this place and this occasion. But every graduation address I've ever given has ended, and this one will too, with old stuff about my Uncle Alex, my father's kid brother. A Harvard graduate, Uncle Alex was locally useful in Indianapolis as an honest insurance agent. He was also well-read and wise. One thing which Uncle Alex found objectionable about human beings was that they seldom took time out to notice when they were happy. He himself did his best to acknowledge it when times were sweet. We could be drinking lemonade in the shade of an apple tree in the summertime, and he would interrupt the conversation to say, "If this isn't nice, what is?" So I hope that you Adams and Eves before me will do the same for the rest of your lives. When things are going sweetly and peacefully, please pause a moment and then say out loud, "If this isn't nice, what is?" That's one favor I've asked of you. Now I ask you for another one. I ask it not only of the graduates, but of everyone here. I want a show of hands, and I really will want a show of hands, after I ask this question. How many of you have had a teacher at any level in your educations who made you more excited to be alive, prouder to be alive than you had previously believed possible? Hold up your hands, please. All right. Now, take down your hands and say the name of that teacher to someone sitting near you. Thank you. If this isn't nice, what is? That isn't my whole speech. That's just what I did at Houston. And so now you've heard the kind of graduation address I give. What are my books about? Well, they aren't about middle-class Germans in the Middle West. I'm not crazy. I didn't want to go broke. They were written intuitively, reflexively, as though I were skiing down a steep mountain slope. There was no time to think. I will soon be 76, and then 89, and then 112. I already lived longer than Steinbeck or Hemingway or almost any other writer you can name except Tolstoy. So I pause and look back, so to speak, at the marks my skis made on a mountain slope. I see that I wrote again and again about ordinary people who tried to behave decently in an indecent society. I got a letter from a sappy woman a while back. She wrote me because she knew I was sappy too, which is to say a lifelong Democrat. She was... She was pregnant, and she wanted to know if it was a terrible mistake to bring an innocent baby into a world as awful as this one is. I replied that what made being alive almost worthwhile for me was meeting saints who were everywhere. By saints, I meant ordinary people who were behaving decently in an indecent society. And I hope that many of you people here are or will become saints for her child to meet. Now, you're entitled to know that I am honorary president of the American Humanist Association. I have succeeded the late great biochemist and science fiction writer Isaac Asimov in that essentially functionless capacity. Now, we have an organization at all. A boring business is to let politicians know that we exist and that we are numerous and respectable. We'd prefer simply to live our lives as humanists and not talk about it or think about it any more than we think about breathing. Are we enemies of organized religion? Absolutely not. My great war buddy, now dead, lost faith as a Roman Catholic during World War II. I didn't like that. I thought it was too much to lose. I had never had faith like that because I was raised by good citizens who were skeptics about religion. But I knew that he had lost something very important and honorable. Again, I did not like that. He was a Pennsylvanian, incidentally, named Bernard O'Hare, and was the district attorney for a while. In being a humanist, I'm simply honoring my mother and my father, which the Bible says is a good thing to do. They were not rascals, crooks, or hellraisers of any sort. Humanists try to behave decently and honorably without any expectation of rewards or punishments in an afterlife. Since the creator of the universe is unknowable to us so far, we serve as best we can the highest abstraction of which we have some understanding, which is our community. Historically, we've been law-abiding, and most strikingly so, with respect to the Bill of Rights of the Constitution of the United States, which requires a separation of church and state. I spoke at a Humanist Association memorial service for Isaac Asimov a couple of years back, and at one point I said, "Isaac is in heaven now." This was the funniest thing I could have said to an audience of humanists. It rolled him in the aisles, and it... It took several minutes before order could be restored. And when I die, God forbid, I hope that you will say that about me, that he is in heaven now. Now, am I high tech? Well, Forbes magazine asked me recently what my favorite technology was, and I said the Encyclopedia Britannica. I love it because it feels so good. And you get to dance. You know, you don't have to just sit in one place and work keys. You get to dance. Go to the shelf, open this thing, and you can feel it with your fingertips, you know. It smells good and everything. And also, if you move around some, your bowels are going to move. If you don't... If you don't... Now, I am a great creative writing teacher. I taught at the Writers' Workshop in Iowa for a couple of years. I've taught at Harvard. Harvard. Got it? Is there anybody here who is writing a piece of fiction, a book or a short story or a drama, which somehow isn't working? Would you hold up your hands? There's nobody. Oh, you. Where's the person? All right, I'm telepathic. Throw away the first six pages. All you've done is introduce yourself to the reader, and the reader doesn't give a damn who you are. They want a story. And, you know, in that first six pages, you'll demonstrate you can really write before you get to the story. Look, throw away the first six pages, and that story is going to be moving, and the reader is going to have to run to catch up, and it's going to be exciting. Okay? There's something else wrong? You're one character short. The missing character is Iago. It's somebody who makes your rather uninteresting characters move around, you know, by double-crossing, lying, putting thumbtacks on the chairs and stuff. And the reader will be so glad Iago showed up. And do not make another bonehead mistake by explaining how Iago got that way. Nobody gives a damn. They're just glad he's there. Now, is my mic working here?
Slide it up a little bit. It's a little bit.
I'm.
I'm perfectly capable of projecting in a hall this size.
All right. What the guy who introduced me failed to announce whoever he was. I hold a master's degree from the University of Chicago in anthropology, and it was a big mistake because I can't stand primitive people. They're so stupid. I've also been educated as an undergraduate as a chemist, for which, a field for which I had no talent whatsoever. But whenever I'm on a university faculty, I'm in the English department, although I've never studied English. But I have brought scientific thinking to literary criticism, and there's been very little gratitude for this. Stories, in fact, have very nice shapes, which a computer would understand, and which you will understand, too. This is the GI axis. Good fortune, ill fortune. Great prosperity, perfect health, and death and poverty down here. Average state of affairs here. This is the BE axis. B stands for beginning. E stands for electricity. Now, I'll give you a marketing tip here. The people who can afford to go to plays and read books and magazines, magazine fiction and so forth, don't like to hear about poor people or sick people. So start your story up here. Now, a story that's just told over and over again, and I don't get tired of it, everybody loves it. I call it Man in Hole, but it needn't be about a man or a hole. It's somebody gets into trouble, gets out of it again. People love that story, and it's inspiring. And it's encouraging to the reader, you know. Maybe, by God, I'm a human being too, you know. Maybe I've got that much in reserve too if things get really tough. Another one is, I call it Boy Gets Girl, but it needn't be about a boy or a girl. It's somebody on a day like any other day, expecting absolutely nothing, comes across something perfectly wonderful. Oh, boy, this is my lucky day. Shit. He gets it back again. Now, there's a very pessimistic story by Franz Kafka, and it starts down here. And this young man who's not very personable or good-looking, he lives in Prague, and he has a very uninteresting family, and a lousy job, and it doesn't pay enough for him to take a girl dancing or to go to a beer hall with a buddy or anything. He doesn't have any buddies. And so he wakes up one morning, it's time to go to work, and he has turned into a cockroach. Now, one of the most popular stories of all time, violates my rule, starts down here. Who is this that's so low? Well, it's a girl, a little girl, whose mother has died. It's not very funny, is it? And her father has gotten married almost immediately to a terrible battle axe with two mean daughters. You've heard it. Okay, so there's a party at the palace. The daughters and the stepmother and the father are all going to go. Cinderella has to stay home. Now, as they leave, does she become even more unhappy? No, she's a stout-hearted little girl. Maximum grief is the death of her mother. So the fairy godmother shows up and gives her pantyhose and lipstick and means of transportation, everything you need to do. You need to have to go to a party and have a good time. And so she goes to the party, and the prince falls in love with her. She's so beautiful. Now, this girl is so heavily made up, you realize her own relatives don't recognize her. Okay, so the clock strikes 12. She loses all the stuff. But do we drop down to the same level? No. No matter what happens next, she will remember when she was the belle of the ball and the prince was in love with her. So she poops along at this considerably improved level until the shoe fits and she becomes off-scale happy. Now, as I told you, I studied anthropology. And, you know, I said what I thought about primitive people are stupid, and they deserve to lose. Proof of this was in the library there at Chicago. I would go and get stories gathered by ethnographers and other people visiting primitive people, and these stories just stunk. They were dead level, like the BE axis here. As we came to a river, we came to a mountain, this little beaver died. And you couldn't tell what the good news was and what the bad news was. And why the hell anybody would listen to one of these stories, I don't know. Now, does this scheme here have any value, actually, in literary criticism? It's possible. It's possible that a true masterpiece cannot be crucified on a cross of this design. So, all right, let's just see. What is the greatest literary treasure we have in the English language? If I say Hamlet, would many people disagree? You better not, or you'll spoil the whole evening. Okay, so let's see how Hamlet works on this scheme. Don't need to draw a new line here. Same thing, as he's of the opposite sex, but a beloved parent has died, and the surviving parent has married an unattractive person almost immediately. So, all right. So Hamlet's friend comes down from the parapet and says, "Hey, there's this thing up here on the parapet, I think you better talk to it. It claims it's your father." And the father's dead, supposedly. So Hamlet goes up there, and this thing says, "Hey, I was murdered by your uncle, who's now married to your mother. And here's how he did it. And you've got to straighten this out. You've got to avenge me somehow." Is this good news or bad news? We don't know what this thing was. It may not actually be Hamlet's father. As those of you who've horsed around with Ouija boards know that the world is full of malicious spirits who are liable to say anything to you just to cause trouble for human beings. So we don't know if it's good news or bad news. So Hamlet decides, "Well, I got this neat scheme to check this story out." He hires some actors and tells them to act out the murder as it was described to him by the ghost, and to have his uncle watch, and then maybe go crazy like in a Perry Mason story. You know, it's like, I can't stand it. Yes, I did it. I did it. So they put on the play, and nothing happened. To fizzle, to flop. So Hamlet is talking to his mother after this fizzle, and the draperies move. And he says, "Okay, that's my uncle behind the draperies. I'm sick of being indecisive." And he pulls out his sword, sticks it through the draperies. Well, who falls out? It's Polonius, this big, fat windbag. This Rush Limbaugh. So is this good news or bad news? Well, Shakespeare himself regards this man as a windbag, as a clown. Is Polonius' advice to his children about when they're going out into the world is, in Shakespeare's mind, the utterly useless advice parents give to their children before they go out in the world, is neither a borrower nor a lender be. Thanks a lot, Dad. And this above all, to thine own self be true, of so easy to do, a piece of cake. So, all right, Hamlet's not going to get arrested. He can kill anybody he wants. He's a prince. So we go on, and he finally gets in a duel, and he dies. He's killed. Now, did he go to heaven or hell? We don't know. Shakespeare does not tell us, and perhaps Shakespeare, like me, doesn't believe in an afterlife. Anyway, if he goes to hell, he's as unhappy as Kafka's cockroach. If he goes to heaven, he's as happy as Cinderella. But I have just proved to you that Shakespeare is as poor a storyteller as any quackyoodle. Have I cooked the books? No. And I have, in fact, demonstrated to you why we recognize this as a masterpiece. It tells us the truth, which is, we don't really know what the good news is and what the bad news is. And we are grateful for someone finally to tell us that truth. We are taught to pretend that we know what the good news is and what the bad news is. A little kid, 2 years old or something, the parents come up just so excited. The most wonderful piece of information they have. Oh, boy, they can hardly stand it. And the little kid is, he's glad when his parents are happy and he's somehow involved in this. And what do they tell the kid? It's your birthday. What could be a more empty piece of information? But the parents are so happy that the kid wants to be happy too. And so it goes on, is our team won? Yeah, yeah, yeah. The political candidate won. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I told you I'm a humanist. I don't believe in an afterlife. But I would like to go to heaven very briefly to ask somebody, hey, what was the good news and what was the bad news? That's my end of my speech.
Isn't this nice? Mr. Vonnegut has agreed to answer a few questions, and there are people holding microphones. And what I will try to do is to, call on people at various parts of the auditorium. I see a gentleman. Bob has his hand up right here. Can we bring the microphone down? Oh, well, we use the mics of the people upstairs. I will tell you.
Hello.
Wait. I will tell you that there is a a room upstairs, the lobby just chock full of people, not just on the chairs but on the floor. So we absolutely need to use the microphones for asking the questions so that they can be part of this also.
Overall, was your experience in the military a positive or a negative influence on your life? No, that's a serious question. Was it a positive overall or negative?
It was socially and politically tremendously positive, because I can say anything I want because I'm a veteran. And and there's only one higher rank than that, and that's mother. No, I wouldn't have missed it for anything. I was in perfect physical health and young, and it was a great adventure. I mean, it was lousy, but it didn't last that long. And I have said to every sort of audience, you know, all over Europe and all over the United States, about the firebombing of Dresden, is not only one person on the face of the earth benefited from this destruction of this beautiful city. Not one person got out of a concentration camp a microsecond earlier. Not one German soldier fell back from his defensive position a microsecond earlier. They're the only person on earth who benefited from the firebombing of Dresden is me. And I made about $5 for every person killed. And nobody's ever argued with that.
All right, let's have a question now from this side. I see a woman right in the middle there with her hand up, and then we'll come back to either this side or the other. Okay.
I don't have a question. I would just like to say to you, Mr. Vonnegut, that you are the teacher who made the biggest difference and added the most excitement to my life, and I thank you for that.
Wow. Thank you.
That doesn't count. We were going to do 10 questions. We won't do that. Okay, let's have it's hard for me to see, so okay, right here. And then, who had their hand up here so we can get the microphone ready to go to them? The next person after this, who on this side of the house wanted to ask a question? Well, go ahead, right here.
What else gets you through besides the chance of meeting a saint and the idea of community?
Well, is that a medical question?
can I whisper to you?
It's a secret between us.
Now, we're going to have an auction at our borrower's ball. And for the appropriate bid, all right, another question, please. Gentleman right up front.
Did you take any part in the production of Breakfast of Champions, and are you participating in or being in the movie?
I was in it, and I have no idea what the quality of it is, but we certainly had a lot of fun.
Did you play yourself, or did somebody else?
No, I played a guy making a commercial for the automobile agency as directing a TV crew, and Albert Finney, incidentally, is Kilgore Trout.
Oh,
and I'm out of here. Good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to urge those of you who are down here in the auditorium, if, you know, perhaps you want to share some ideas with each other about your favorite teacher, some of the things. We want to give, the upstairs is so full, we need to give them time to leave. So we'd like you to just hold off for a few minutes before we go upstairs. Once there is a little more room, it'll be much easier. And also you'll recall, and you see in your program, that there are pre-signed copies of Mr. Vonnegut's books available for sale. And those of you who have tickets for the special reception, that will be upstairs, and there will be staff who will be guiding you to that area. When you go up to the top of the steps, I believe it will be to the right. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.